Hashtag Sisters-in-Law is going on tour in May. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour. You can see us live at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago on May 2nd, the Royal Oak Music Theater in Detroit on May 9th, and the Schubert Theater in Boston on May 30th. Go to politicon.com/tour to get your tickets now.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guests are the authors of Rural White Rage, Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write in to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. And we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, Beam, Naked Wines, and Real Paper, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Hey, James, for President Biden, pretty good 7 days since our last podcast. The State of the Union was forceful, hitting the right notes and playing off Republicans very well. To those who were looking for JFK or FDR, they were delusional. This is the best Biden can do. I liked his budget. I think it's a political budget. Of course, it's an election year. What he really wants to do is put a modest extra tax on the super wealthy to A, fund programs like expanded child tax credit, which keeps millions out of poverty, and reduce the deficit. These are good policies, good politics, and draw contrast with Trump. The buffoonery of Marjorie Taylor Greene and the GOP rebuttal of Katie Britt, you know, James, that may be the worst of all times. It's tough competition, but it's right up there. You know, and finally, House Republicans hauled Biden's special counsel, Robert Hur, to Capitol Hill. It turns out the president's memory lapses while there weren't quite as bad as the politically ambitious Republican prosecutor conveyed. Now, the initial polls show Biden received no bounce from the State of the Union, but two legends who taught me polling, Peter Hart and Bob Teeter, always said, they don't pay attention to the polls right after event. They wait to the second batch, those that come out in a week or 10 days. If they don't show even a small bounce, you know, that's a cause for concern, but we'll wait and see.
Well, you hit what I'm thinking on the head. And there were two polls, by the way. It was like a YouGov and a Ipsos. And it, of course, you would want to wait. But unfortunately, the feeling is if you get a sugar high, there are no sugar highs out there. And you're right, it couldn't have had a better week. They couldn't have had a worse week. Also, Haley drops out, which you would have hoped would have been some consolidation a little bit toward Biden. As Peter and Bob Teeter said, you know, give it another week. But at some point, we're always saying, well, let's give this thing another month. It'll turn around. What really bothers me is when things turn around, very often you can see some of the economic views toward the economy have gotten better. But I'm just like you. I'm nervously waiting the next couple
Well, and
polls
also,
here.
You know, look, you look for whatever you can, because let's face it, Biden is not a strong candidate, nor will he ever be. He is getting gifts from Republicans. Donald Trump raised the issue of going after Social Security and Medicare on a CNBC interview. He'll deny he said it, but it's on tape, and I suspect it'll be on political commercials soon. And up in the House, Jim Jordan and James Comer, you know, Inspector Clouseau's without the charm. So they may send a criminal referral to the Justice Department on either Hunter or Joe Biden. That, of course, is a total phony. They just want to then accuse Justice of covering up. Maybe when they're doing that, James, they could see if they can send a criminal referral to the state of Ohio. That may not be possible, but that's where the current chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan, you will remember, we shouldn't let our listeners forget this, has been credibly accused by more than six Ohio State wrestlers of covering up a doctor's sexual assaults on athletes when Jordan was an assistant wrestling coach. That's, by the way, much, much better witnesses than Jordan and company's chief witness against Hunter Biden, who it turns out probably is a Russian agent. So, you know, there's some stuff there. And Trump, you know, the other thing we discovered this week, Trump isn't nearly as wealthy as he boasts or successful, you know, when he had to put up those bonds and didn't have as much cash as he had always told us he had. Way back in 2016, Mike Bloomberg, a legitimate billionaire, multi-billionaire who uses his money for notable purposes, used to tell us that Trump was a phony billionaire. Wasn't worth anywhere near that. Now we know he was right.
So if you think of, let's forget about President Biden's poll numbers. The strengths and weaknesses going in here. Democrats have a bucket load more money than they do. They're down to fleecing the RNC. In fact, they're credible people that say they don't have sufficient campaign money to put on a rally. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's not a far-fetched, out there thing. They have got stupidity in the Congress on the level that is in a magnitude that is unimaginable, from the narrow majority to idiotic investigations to Boebert and Green and, you know, Ken Buck publicly attacking them.
James, Chip, let me Roy interrupt just for a second. Was them. Katie Britt's response worse than Bobby Jindal?
Wow. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But Bobby Jindal was kind of vacant and, you know, not properly lit. And hers was affirmatively off-putting. I mean, as somebody said, like, she first cut at a high school drama thing. She beat Jindal fair and square. But so they have all of this. At some point, you tell yourself something's got to kick in. That it's just too much going on at the same time. And we don't lose elections. Let's not forget that. And, you know, we got some challenging Senate races, but we do have some advantages, some pretty big advantages going into this. Yeah. Money being one of them.
No, I agree. And the issues should be one too, whether it's abortion or whether it's healthcare or whether it's taxing the wealthy. Those are all really, really good issues.
And correct.
They're on the defensive.
Absolutely. And Mark Robinson,
Mark Robinson is, find out right away. He is the Republican gubernatorial candidate in North Carolina, who may be the looniest of the loons. He has said not only is he for a total ban on abortion, he also has raised the questions of whether women should even be allowed to vote. So, you know, you're absolutely right, James.
When you need a great night's sleep, have a delicious cup of beans. You know, Al, we talk about this all the time on this show. And, you know, when it comes to a good night's sleep, how important it is. And, you know, the tools that modern science has given us. And this is a good tool, dude. And it's kind of fun because you're always taught not to drink coffee or something, you know, anything with caffeine in it before you sleep. And this is something that tastes good and help you sleep. How are you going to get any better than that?
Man, when something is good for you and tastes good, that is a rarity. And that's something you grab right away. Usually it goes the other way. But you know, you're right. Sleep is the foundation of our mental and physical health. You know, when you're sleeping well, you can perform at your best, mentally and physically. Proper sleep can also increase focus, boost energy, and improve your mood. Introducing Beam's Dream Powder, a science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep. Dream has been a game changer for sleep. It was horrible watching hours tick by until the alarm would go off. I remember I'd set an alarm sometime at 6:30 and I'd wake up and it's 5:02 and then I'd look up again and it's 5:20 and then I look up again and it's 5:33. You don't have that problem with Beam. I love knowing that all it takes is one delicious cup of Beam before I get in bed and I'll be sleeping like a baby, ready to take on the day ahead. And today, our listeners get a special discount on Beam's Dream Powder. They're science-backed, healthy hot cocoa for sleep with no added sugar. Better sleep has never tasted better. There's tons of delicious flavors like chocolate peanut butter, cinnamon cocoa, and sea salt caramel. They're only 15 calories with 0 grams of sugar. Now, I like to have a different one every night. It's always a treat. And now one's better sleep no longer keeps you awake at night. Other sleep aids can cause next day grogginess, but Dream contains a powerful, all-natural blend of reishi extract, magnesium, L-theanine, melatonin, and nano-CBD to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up refreshed. The numbers don't lie. A clinical study showed 93% of participants reported Dream helped them get better sleep.
Not bad.
That's pretty
not
darn
bad.
Good, James.
And like I say, it's you get a good night's sleep, and that's the biggest determinant of how you're going to feel the next day.
You ever got 93% in the campaign, James?
No.
So Beam tops James Carville. That's amazing. Beam Dream is easy to add to your nighttime routine. You just mix Dream into a hot water or milk froth and enjoy before bed. You'll find out why Forbes and the New York Times are all talking about Beam and why it's trusted by the world's top athletes and business professionals. If you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder, get up to 40% off for a limited time when you go to shopbeam.com/warroom and use the code warroom at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/warroom and use code warroom for up to 40% off. You also can find the link in our show notes. Hey, James, our guest, Paul Waldman, a prominent journalist, and Tom Schaller, an academic and recovering journalist, have written a fascinating book, White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Paul, this book is about more than Donald Trump voters, but they are the core of many of these, of his support and in many of these communities. They're disproportionately poor. Many suffer from inadequate health care in schools as well as jobs. And yet, rather than those issues that affect their lives, they often are more swayed, Trump is a perfect example, by, I would call, demagoguery, trans children issues, undocumented immigrants, critical race theory. They're getting conned, aren't they? Or they're conning themselves.
Well, it may be a little bit of both. You know, people may remember how much Barack Obama was criticized in 2008 when he said that, you know, people feel in small towns and rural areas as though neither party is really helping them on economics. And so they turn to issues like guns and religion to define their political identity. Remember, he was excoriated about that. It was 15 years ago. People still bring that up in interviews that we do. But he was largely correct. And what happened was people were taught over time that they shouldn't really expect either party to do much for them in terms of improving the circumstances of their lives. And what gets left is those kinds of cultural issues. But Donald Trump came along and he offered something that was correct in some ways and really problematic and demagogic in other ways. So yes, he said that to them too, that neither party has been helping you. The whole system is rigged. And people looked around and said, yeah, that sounds pretty right to us. He also told them some things that were just completely false that they seem to want to hear. So here's an example. He goes in 2016. You remember Hillary Clinton said that we're going to put a lot of coal companies out of business and everybody lost their minds. How dare she be so insulting to the people of coal country? Well, Donald Trump goes in 2016 to West Virginia, puts on a hard hat and says, and I quote, "For all you miners, get ready because you're going to be working your asses off." And the question is, did people know it was a lie, or did people think he was actually telling the truth? Now, it was a lie. When he came into office, there were 52,000 jobs in the entire American coal industry. When he left, it was 38,000. There are about as many Americans who work at Panda Express as work in the entire American coal industry. He did not bring back the coal jobs. And 4 years later, did they all turn against him and say, hey, you didn't do what you said you were going to do? No, they did not. They voted for him in many cases. For instance, in Mingo County, the place in West Virginia that we reported from, he got 83% of the vote in 2016. 4 years later, he got 85% of the vote. And that happened in rural places all over the country. He got more votes in 2020 than he did in 2016.
Wyoming and West Virginia were his two best states in both elections.
The coal states. So it turns out that people – well, it turns out that what people really, really were responding to was not this promise that he was actually going to improve their lives, but it was the idea that he was going to be this vehicle for them to give a giant middle finger to the people they hate. And that's what they like about him. You know, everywhere we went, as we traveled around, people would say to us, well, you know, Trump really speaks our language. And you would think, what the hell are you talking about? This guy from Queens who spent his life trying to be accepted in Manhattan society, he speaks your language? What they meant, it turned out, was that he channels their kind of anger, and they love it when he's vulgar and cruel and xenophobic and bigoted and that kind of stuff. They say, yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm thinking. And this is the first time I've heard a politician say it. And they loved it. And, you know, we talk about four different threats to American democracy, racism and xenophobia and a tolerance for political violence and undermining democratic institutions and conspiracism. And all those things are embodied in Donald Trump. People responded to all those things. Those are the things that a lot of people were feeling. And they took just joy in seeing a politician who said he represented them and hated the same people they hate, and that he would be their voice for that. And now what does he say? He says, I'm going to be your retribution. Well, think about what retribution means. Retribution doesn't make your life any better. It doesn't bring back the things that you've lost. It's just about making somebody else suffer in the way that you think that you've suffered. And that's what he's offering, which was not going to make things any better for rural America in 2028 if he wins in 2024.
I agree. I mean, Trump is the worst villain in this. Elements have been there before. I remember in 16, I went to a small town in western Pennsylvania. And one of the things that really, they were somewhat taken by Trump, but one of the, I think, points they made that really hit me was they asked about the 08-09, what they called depression, the recession, the huge financial crisis. And they said, how are you guys in Washington doing? I said, okay. And they said, and how are those rich guys in Wall Street doing who caused all this? And I said, fine. They said, you know what? We got fucked. And I think that was a legitimate point. Trump had no answer, but he certainly played to it very effectively.
Yeah, I mean, and in the book, we talk about the economic bounce back. After the 90-91 recession, which James Carville was earning his bones in Pennsylvania, I think, back that year, and Clinton used that very minor and short recession just enough to take down George H.W. Bush, rural jobs came back at the same rates as jobs outside of the rural America in the suburbs and the cities. But after the Great Recession of 2008-2007, rural jobs did not come back to the degree that the rest of the country did. And I think with cause, rural Americans said, you know, everybody bounced back. We know we went through this crisis and the rest of the country bounced back and we did kind of a dead cat bounce and didn't come back up with everybody else. And they're not wrong about that. And this goes to a point.
And those other guys caused
it. Yeah. And they, I'm sure they were mad at the corporate executives and so forth. And this is the funny thing. You know, we get angry emails and people are saying, how dare you talk about white rural Americans? You and your socialist buddy should move to Europe and all this other stuff. But it's not socialism that destroyed rural America. It's late stage capitalism. Socialism didn't close those mom and pop shops and replace them with Family Dollar and Dollar Generals. Socialism didn't create mountaintop mining removal where cranes come in and remove the coal by the ton at a time instead of sending miners down through a hole with a pickaxe and a shovel, removing it a pound at a time. Late stage capitalism is the reason that the schools are shrinking and they're consolidating. In Mingo County, they had to take four high schools and consolidate them into one and build it on top of a former coal mine because the four towns had half empty schools and the kids now have to spend an hour on the bus to get to the consolidated school. They're putting teachers on the buses there so they can start schooling while they're still in their yellow buses. It's craziness. And so you can blame socialism. You can blame communism as you troop out to vote for a guy who's favorite international buddy is a former KGB agent, Vladimir Putin. But that's not who ruined rural America. It's late stage capitalism. And you should take a closer look at the people who are voting for those reforms. As Paul has pointed out, Ted Cruz doesn't support rural broadband. He's supporting the big corporations that want to monopolize and oligopolize the delivery of broadband service because they don't want the little guys to compete. That ain't socialism. That's capitalism. Raw, unfiltered, red in tooth and claw capitalism. That is the reason that a rural American who can code for like crazy can't work from home because they don't have a strong enough rural broadband. They can't even interview for that job because they don't have a strong enough rural broadband. And Biden is putting money into it. Trump had, like I said, 4 years and 208 weeks to use an infrastructure week to expand rural broadband. He failed. Biden delivered it in 18 months. We'll see if they reward Biden in 2024, but I predict they won't.
You guys go out and about and talking about your book in rural America, but they're there, and they're a powerful voting bloc, and they're not particularly favorable Democrats. And so the question becomes, how do you talk to them? I'll give you my idea for whatever it's worth. It won't contradict with anything you say. Is everything is biblical. So part of their narrative is they were forgotten people. They'd been discarded by the coastal elites and whatever, and academics. And along comes this guy, his deliverance. He sees us. He recognized us. We believed him. We had every reason in the world to look for this. And then he betrayed us. Because betrayal is always part of the biblical narrative. So you're telling the voter that I understand how you got there. And I understood, you know, I understand that you didn't like TikTok and the Communist Party of China and the things that you saw. But what did he do? At one meeting, he betrayed you. He told you he was going to open the coal mines. What did he do? He gave tax cuts to the rich. It's not your fault. The problem is you felt like you had been discarded and you felt like that he was the guy that was going to come and pick you up and no such thing happened. And now he's talking about cutting Social Security.
I think this is the right message, James, but it's got to be peer to peer. I mean, nobody's going to listen to Paul and I, and that's fine. We're trying to start a next.
Well, No, people will listen to you. You know who will listen to you? Is candidates. When you do an interview, campaign strategists and pollsters and people are listening to you.
I know that.
Organizers are listening to us. People that read your book are what I'd call a self-selecting sample. So I'm running the Senate race in Wisconsin or the Senate race in Michigan or Pennsylvania. And I see this book, I'm going to read it. And I'm saying, these guys, they're on television. And all that nonsense shit you hear on NPR, identity politics on steroids, too many people pay attention to that. But no, you have real power when you go out there.
I mean, I know that rural organizers are talking about this book, and some are mad at us, but mostly because they say it's making their job a little harder. They're trying to lure these people back like, you know, frightened deer in the backyard to come back toward the Democratic Party and vote for progressive values and vote to save their communities. And they're like, please don't startle them. And when you got a book up there, White Rural Rage, and, you know, Steve Bannon is giving the book to Viktor Orban already, and it's not too long before Trump holds it up at a rally. I realize that doesn't help the cause in rural America. But peer-to-peer with local rural progressive organizers, this can be done. And I think your message is exactly right, James, about betrayal in a biblical way, because Trump does not care about – he's asking people who don't have $25 to scratch together to pay his damn legal fees and bankrupt the Republican Party to bail his ass out, this phony billionaire who doesn't have enough money to make his bonds, right? And he has not delivered a single thing for rural America. You know who's delivered for rural America? Joe Biden created a program during COVID. He did not put his name on it. He did not put his administration's name on it. He put tens of millions of dollars into it to educate people about the safety of the free vaccines. He used the National Milk Producers Federation and other agricultural trade groups, and he used faith-based organizations. And by the way, Joe Biden's in church every Sunday. The other guy is never in church. And he used local gatekeepers, and they increased the vaccine rates in white rural communities. Joe Biden literally saved thousands of lives of people who are going to turn out and vote against him. There's a term for that. That's patriotic. That's leadership. And I think the Democrats should start talking about that in rural areas and let people know who's got their back and who's just trying to get them, you know, get their dander up.
Yeah, I want to pick up on one point there. My wife went to Steubenville, Ohio. It's not really rural, but it's the kind of community you're talking about. And they complained about Washington does nothing for us. Biden's been terrible. They have a sparkling new STEM high-tech high school center. I mean, it's really impressive. Where did they get that money? They got that money from the American Rescue Plan, but it doesn't register. And I don't know whose fault that is. I don't know whether, you know, Biden or politicians aren't doing enough, but I mean, that's the pride of that community. And yet they're going to vote again 70% for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's an old problem, too. And part of it is that, as Tom said, there are some contexts in which Biden kind of didn't want to draw too much attention to what he was doing. And then there are things where he does it and nobody really notices. The media doesn't report on it. You know, so they've spent they're spending tens of billions of dollars to extend broadband to rural areas. And I know, you know, there are some people who dismiss that as like, oh, it's just a cliche. It is really important. There are studies that have found that's one of the most important things in creating economic dynamism in rural communities is having access to broadband. So he's spending tens of billions of dollars on doing it. He has this whole industrial policy that's all about reviving areas that have been left behind. And a lot of it doesn't have, you know, his name with a big picture of him on the front of it. And yes, people are inclined to not believe that anything good that came from that happens in their community could possibly have come from Washington. If it's bad, it came from Washington. If it's good, we did it ourselves.
Well, let me give you another example. Medicaid expansion. There is no issue that more affects these communities. Every time it goes in a ballot, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Missouri passes overwhelmingly. But two places that fascinate me, North Carolina, where finally the pressure from below has made the right-wing legislators take on, and pass Medicaid expansion. But they pay no price for 12 years of resisting. And Mississippi, my kid was down there for a governor's race. I mean, that's the poorest healthcare outcomes in America in one of 10 states that doesn't have it. Now there's some pressure, but this idiot governor who just won re-election is saying, I'm going to veto it. They don't pay a price. Tom?
Absolutely.
They should. They should. I mean, we talked to black legislators in North Carolina because we actually interviewed people of color in rural America, unlike most. They're invisible. Nobody ever talks about them. And so we went to the Albemarle region, which is seven counties that are majority rural and majority black, clustered on either side of I-95, just as you come over the Virginia border. In fact, when you come over 95 from Virginia, North Carolina, the first town you see is Enfield, North Carolina, which is the county seat of Halifax County, about 22,000 people, 2,200 live. And the legislators there all told us that privately, the Republicans, who are almost all white, said, we're afraid to adopt Medicaid expansion in North Carolina because if we give somebody a benefit, what if it disappears or Obamacare gets reversed by their own party, by the way, then we got to claw something back and that's really dangerous. So their view is like, let's let people suffer for the next 10 years because it's better to just let them suffer permanently than to actually improve their lives. And you know who proved that the Medicaid expansion worked? Not us, Jonathan Metzl, dying from whiteness. He looked at Kentucky where Steve Beshear very shrewdly didn't call it Obamacare. He called it Connect, K-Y-N-N-E-C-T. And everybody in Kentucky said, this is the greatest healthcare program. Why can't we get this?
Including
Meanwhile,
Mitch
they're
McConnell.
Voting against Obamacare, even though they don't know it is Obamacare.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, neighboring Tennessee, the health metrics, the life expectancy went down, the mortality rent went up, the uninsured rate stayed the same or went up. It's like a perfect little natural experiment. Kentucky thrived under Obamacare. Tennessee is one of those 10 states, Al, you said. I'm not familiar with the metrics in Mississippi. It's still one of the 10 states that refuses to do it. And they're suffering accordingly and then complaining about socialism and big government. So you tell me why they don't know that. I don't think it's because rural people are stupid. I don't think it's because rural people are blind. I don't think it's because rural people are ignorant. I think they are getting fed a steady diet of repeal and replace by their politicians who don't want to tell them the truth.
And you can't overstate how important Medicaid is in rural communities.
Paul, Tom, your book is called Rural White Rage. Of course, being that I definitely would, under any demographic characterization, I would be rural white. So what did you find that people are most raged about?
It's a lot of things.
Go ahead, Paul.
And let me sort of give you the kind of big structure of what we're looking at. Our argument is basically that, first of all, white rural people have a disproportionate amount of political power within our system. And therefore, when they are angry and when they express that in political ways, especially in ways that don't necessarily end up solving problems, but end up exacerbating problems, is particularly problematic for our democracy. They kind of punch above their weight in a lot of ways. Even if, as we argue, their power is not being used for much productive ends, especially when it comes to their own lives. So if you look, you know, we have a whole chapter about the problems in rural America that some people are probably familiar with. There's a lack of economic opportunity in a lot of places. There's been economic decline, especially as manufacturing jobs have moved out. There's a lack of healthcare access. Schools are not what people would wish they would be. There is things like infrastructure problems, not enough access to broadband, which is really important both for businesses and just for people in the quality of their lives. So there's a lot of different problems that rural America faces. But unfortunately, they have been told by the people who they keep electing that the way to engage in politics isn't really to demand anything like accountability from the people you keep electing. All that you need to do is express your anger and your resentment at the ballot box. You need to go into politics just to tell liberals, to tell urbanites, to tell immigrants, to tell Black Lives Matter, whoever it is, that you don't like them, and here's our big middle finger to you, obviously, especially in the person of Donald Trump. And so one of our arguments is that there has to be a more productive way for them to engage in politics, and the end point of that has to be accountability. You know, as I'm sure you know, James, there are many, many rural areas where there is just no political competition whatsoever. You know, every elected official from U.S. Senator all the way down to dog catcher is a Republican. And this is often presented as a problem for Democrats that Democrats need to solve. They need to go into these areas that they've abandoned. They need to talk to people. They need to present themselves respectfully and listen to them and understand the conditions of their lives. And that's all well and good. But nobody ever says to Republicans, what are you doing in rural areas? Because Republicans have abandoned these areas in a lot of ways, too. They're still the ones getting elected, but they're not, don't have active political organizations. They're not out there trying to solve people's problems. And the consequence is that nobody is asking those Republicans who represent these places, like, what are you doing for us? Did you get us better access to healthcare? Did you improve our schools? Did you create more economic opportunity? Are you actually making our lives better? The Republicans, all they do is they come in on election day and they say, don't you hate liberals? I do too. Vote for me. And people do. And then none of those problems end up getting solved.
So let me add this, a question I asked both of you. Some of this, at least I felt over my lifetime, that the role of the rural white American culturally is been in decline. There used to be movies made about rural whites and Audie Murphy and Sergeant York, and you had Andy Griffin, and you had it's kind of front and center in American culture was the heroic rural white. Now, in the culture, they don't exist very much. Did y'all find that there's some cultural resentment that's driving this?
Do you want me to take that one, Tom? Or do you want to? Yeah, I think that there is some of that. And people do say that, you know, we don't see ourselves on TV and movies and things like that. But it's a complicated picture, you know. We may not see as much of the really negative stuff as we used to, you know, things like Deliverance and that kind of thing. But what we do see, there are actually a lot of cultural presentations that show rural life is really admirable. You know, people know about those kind of Lifetime and Hallmark movies that all have the same plot, where some woman, a young woman from the big city, gets kind of stranded in a small town and discovers that that's where people are really honest and true, and that's where life is really rich and enjoyable. And then she dumps her boyfriend back in the big city and decides to stay there in the small town. And so you do have stuff like that. There's a lot of, but there's also a lot of like reality TV that shows people in rural areas, not always in very complimentary ways. And so you do find a lot of people who feel like popular culture doesn't represent them well. But there's also in culture a lot of kind of veneration of rural people. And that's in political culture and in popular culture. You know, you have those kind of Lifetime movies. You have politicians who say that what we really need is small town values and that that's really important. Like, nobody has ever heard a politician say we need big city values in Washington. You could make a case for that, but nobody ever says that. The small town values are the ones that are supposed to be the real virtuous things, and that's what we really need to honor. And so there is a kind of a complexity in the way rural people are represented in culture. But yes, you do find a lot of people who will say, you know, we feel like we're ignored or we feel like we're not represented. But one of the things that we find most interesting is that there are people on the right in big cities who keep telling people in rural areas, you're being denigrated. They hate you. I mean, nowhere does that message come more strongly than from Fox News, which is headquartered where? In New York. That's a lot of the messages that people get in rural areas, that they ought to be resentful. So it's not just that they're reacting to something that's objectively true in the world, but it's also something that they are constantly being persuaded to feel. Do you have anything to add, Tom?
We don't call rural white folks hayseeds and hicks and rubes and morons. We don't denigrate them. And yes, there are some cultural depictions that do that in popular media and TV. And maybe those stereotypes shouldn't be out there, whether it's Kenneth Parcells on one of my favorite shows, 30 Rock, who's a hayseed from Stone Mountain, Georgia, right? But to borrow from 30 Rock, our issue is with something I call her my TV girlfriend, Tina Fey, says, which is she pushes back in one of the episodes about this notion that somehow people from flyover and heartland America are more real. Our view isn't that they're any less real. We think a 65-year-old Vietnam vet who's a white man and a father and a grandfather who's a social conservative living in Northwest Iowa is no more or no less real than a 22-year-old Afro-Latina single woman who's getting her degree in art history and Ubering at night. Those people, as Tina Fey would say, just want to have their sandwich and their diet Sprite and be left alone for lunch. The sandwich may differ depending on where they're living. They might call it a hoagie, or they might call it a hero, or they might call it a po' boy down in your part of the country. But this notion that somehow rural white Americans are more real than the rest of Americans, that we say is the sort of mythological advantage they've long held. And you add that to their mathematical advantage, they're overrepresented in the Senate because of malapportion. They're overrepresented in the Electoral College because it's malapportion with the two Senate electors, just ask President Hillary Clinton or President Al Gore. And actually, in our book, we show that they're more overrepresented in the House than the Senate or the presidential election process. So they have this mathematical or numerical advantage, and you compound that with this notional or mythological advantage, and they literally cast an inflated vote, and they are given this cultural deference that you can't criticize them. Look at the blowback from our book. People are calling us racist for criticizing white people, and last time I checked, I'm white, and so is Paul.
So, I agree. They're strategically placed. We have an election coming up. It's not going to change. If House Democrats or Senate Democrats ask you to speak, how would you advise that they approach this, Joe? This group. How do we stem the bleeding, or how do we bounce back a little bit?
I don't know. On the one hand, I think maybe white rural America has reached peak sort of Republican support. As you probably know, James, they voted 62% for Trump against Hillary Clinton in 2016. They voted 71% for Trump, and the white rural percentage in the midterm elections in between steadily went from 62 on up to 71. And I think they actually voted a slightly higher rate in the 2022 midterm. So they're gravitating toward the Republican Party. By the way, if you take out white rural voters from the 2020 results, that means the rest of the country, which moved about 2.3% for Biden overall, you take white rural votes out, the rest of the country moved 3 points toward Biden between Hillary in 2016 and Biden. The rest of the country, white rural Americans moved 9% toward Trump. So they went 9% in this direction. The rest of America went 3 points. That is a 12% gap between the response to 4 years of racist, xenophobic, authoritarian, conspiracist, and violent messages and rhetoric from Donald Trump. And rural white Americans said, give us more, please. And the rest of the country, not in droves, but about 3% said, no, we're tired of that stuff. So can they be clawed back? I like to think, James, that they've reached peak Republican and that they can't get any higher than that. Now, maybe the next election cycle, they're going to be 74% here in November. I don't know, and I don't make predictions like that. But I like to think that the Democrats have sort of got their backs up against the Alamo here, and they're going to claw back against that because people are waking up in rural America to the fact that Donald Trump sells them a nonstop diet of fury, and he didn't get an infrastructure week done. He had 208 weeks over 4 years. He never delivered on that. His tax cuts for the rich and the corporation, I don't think that bled down to rural America. And, you know, all of his conspiracism about COVID, guess what? The first wave after the vaccine was out, rural counties died 2.4 times the rates of the national average and 3 times the rates of urban areas because they didn't get the vaccine, because they've been fed a steady diet of Fauci-ouchy conspiracism. And by estimates from the Daily Yonder and their reporter, Sarah Millott, 140,000 rural Americans died excessively because of the higher rate of deaths and the lower vaccine rates in rural America. That's 140,000 people Trump and his supporters put in their graves. And if the Democrats had done that, you'd hear about it, but nobody talks about it because it's the Republicans and their conspiracism that led rural white people to be vaccine skeptics. And that scientific skepticism cost people their lives and clogged up those rural hospitals, which were closing even before COVID came.
And, you know, James, I would add something to that, too. You know, the standard advice that's always given to Democrats is you need to show up, you need to listen to people, you need to be respectful, and that's how you win votes in rural America. That is necessary but not sufficient. And we've seen that over and over again. There are lots of Democrats who have done that, and they still lost. You know, and maybe they picked up a few extra votes, but it wasn't enough. And I think, and our book isn't really about trying to give Democrats strategic advice, but I think that the missing piece of that is that they haven't been willing to attack Republicans in rural areas and to say to those people, look, you need to demand more from the people you keep electing. And that's why we say near the end of our book, you know, we're not saying that every white rural American should vote for Democrats, you know, maybe some of them should. What they really need to do for a first step is to get themselves some better Republicans. And I think that's an argument that Democrats ought to make. They ought to say to people, look at the people you're electing. What are they doing for you? And hold them accountable. And that's one of the key missing pieces of rural politics is that they are not holding the people they elect accountable.
So, you know, every author hates a pissy review. So I'm going to give you a chance to respond to something I saw in Newsweek. Unfortunately, no one but me probably reads Newsweek. But some academic said that your work, you misinterpreted some work. Or what's behind all that?
Well, academics, and I'm a political scientist, Paul is not. You know, academics are responding negatively because when they have findings that show that, for example, racial resentment factors into racial consciousness, or a recent finding from one of our critics, Cal Muniz, who finds that rural people who are resentful are more likely to call for violence against the state. So when they find things that, like, rural Americans are no different from everybody else, they take the megaphone out and they shout it to the rooftops. But then when they find xenophobia, when they find evidence for conspiracism, when they find evidence that rural whites, and the woman who wrote that, are more anti-intellectual, then they whisper it in a conference room at a political science conference because they don't want to offend. And this is a big part of what we're talking about in Chapter 4 and Chapter 5. You're not allowed to say these things. For all the talk about political correctness and for all the talk about how you're not allowed to criticize minorities and gays, and maybe there is some truth to that. Maybe we have gone a little too far on PC about criticizing people. But white rural Americans get a little bit of a kid glove treatment too. And we're not trying to criticize them. We're just saying, look at what the data says. The Trump voter backbone of the Trump voter coalition is white rural voters. And if you want to tell me that they move 9 points toward Trump because of his tax cuts and his failure on the infrastructure instead of his nonstop messages of xenophobia, shithole countries, Muslim bans, conspiracism, anti-democratic wannabe dictator policies, and his incitement of a riot that attacked our Capitol, a domestic terrorist attack, and you want to tell me that they were really attracted to Trump because he tells it like it is and he gave tax cuts to rich people and corporations, I have to feel that it is really driven by all of those other things that we find in higher supply in white rural America, whether they want to admit it or not.
Paul, you got. I figured I'd light you up on that one.
Yeah, we're taking fire from all angles, James.
So, all right.
Well, listen,
all right, Albert, that was great.
This has been a terrific conversation. The book is White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. Tom Schaller and Paul Wallman, go out and get it today, whether you are a campaign manager, an organizer, a journalist, or just an interested citizen. Tom and Paul.
Boys, y'all have influence. Use it.
Thanks a lot, guys. Rural progressives can save rural America and save democracy. That's our macro message. Let's do it.
Thank you, guys.
When you want great wine at home, order from Naked Wines.
James, I'm going to ask you an easy question again. How great is a glass of wine, especially when you can find what you want online with Naked Wines?
Well, not as good as two glasses of wine, but it's pretty good.
Two glasses of Naked Wines is better than one glass of Naked Wines. Good point.
And these guys do such a good job of selecting. You know, most people, I know a little bit about wine, but you go to a wine store and you're trying to figure out, you know, this or that, or what's a new producer, what year was this and everything. And I know a little bit of, I know enough to know that the selections they make are really well priced and really good variety of good selection. You can't go wrong with the service.
No, you can't. You know, this podcast is sponsored by Naked Wines, a subscription service that seamlessly connects you to the finest independent winemakers on the planet. With Naked Wines, you get a box filled with the market's best quality wines whenever you'd like for a fraction of the price you'd normally pay in stores. Now, how do they do it? You say, come on, really? Naked Wine does it. They connect winemakers and wine drinkers directly, giving you vineyard to your door delivery at up to 60% off store prices by cutting out the traditional retail middleman costs and markups. Winemakers pass those savings on to you without skimping on quality. As a result, you'll get exclusive access to hundreds of top-quality, award-winning wines at a huge saving. Naked Wines is perfect for any wine drink. Now, James and I really don't much like going to the store and being paralyzed by the wine options and prices and waiting lines and all that. It's the luck of the draw sometimes. Now we get exactly what we want. You know what you're getting. Quality wines. No road trips to the store. Naked Wines helps you take any dinner to the next level with the perfect bottle for any occasion. Thanks to Naked Wines, you know, you can just share an Italian dinner paired with a 2018 Dave Harvey Walla Walla Valley Cabernet. It's one to remember. And the best part, every bottle is a passion project from an independent winemaker. So you are literally making independent winemakers' dream come true. There are no commitments or membership fees, and it's hassle-free. So head to nakedwines.com/warroom and click Enter Voucher in the top right when you get to the website and put in War Room for both the code and passwords to get 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99 with shipping including. Let me repeat that. 6 bottles for $39.99 including shipping. That's $100 off and less than $7 a bottle. That's nakedwines.com/warroom and use the code and password warroom and grab 6 bottles for just $39.99. One last time, nakedwines.com/warroom. Code and password War Room for $100 off your first 6 bottles. You also can find the link in our show notes. You know, Mr. Carville, after the violent insurrection of January 6th, when Donald Trump and his allies tried to overturn an American election, one of the heroes was a young White House aide, Cassidy Hutchison, assistant to then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. At professional and personal risk, she testified before that committee that investigated the assault of the Capitol. But House Republicans, Trump pawns, want to prove that what we saw that day, it didn't occur. It was just a peaceful protest. Never mind that almost 1,000 rioters have been convicted, scores more remain under investigation. So what they try to do is discredit honest witnesses like Cassidy Hutchison. Let's take Georgia Congressman Barry Louderman, who the night before the insurrection gave a tour where some took pictures of the stairwells, the security checkpoints, and entries to the Capitol. At least one of them was at the riot the next day. But instead of focusing on the awful stuff that was done January 6th, Louderman could issue a report that charges Hutchison with misrepresentations. Actually, rather small ones, in her congressional testimony. You know, welcome to the thug contingent, Mr. Loudermilk. Cassidy Hutchison has more courage and principle in her little toe than you have in your entire persona.
Yeah, I've known about him before. He's a clown to the first auditor. The problem over there is that there's so many of them, you get confused. You get terribly confused. I guess it is outrageous, but the Katie Britt whole thing, first of all, it was, I watched it again. It was worse than I thought. I knew it was bad when I was looking at it. And then, of course, like everything they do, because the whole thing is a giant grift, she's raising money off of it. Like, so I went on national TV. I made a complete ass of myself. Send me money. And the sad thing is, or the true thing is, They got people out there stupid enough to send her money. And, you know, it's, you look at her and then you look at Nancy Mace on George's show on Sunday. This was not a good week for attractive Southern brunettes. And
well, I think you got a good point there. That's for sure.
Save our planet. Make the switch to real paper. Yeah, you know, we've said it 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000 times again. This environmental stuff, climate stuff, a whole basket of issues or problems we face would only going to be solved by innovative new products that make sense, that don't really distract from somebody's quality of life. In fact, makes it even better. I love this product. I love what they've thought of. I love the pricing of it. I love the texture of it. Everything about it. It's a great product.
It sure is. And here's a history lesson. The first perforated toilet paper rolls were introduced in 1890, but it wasn't until 1930 it was officially splinter-free. Prior to that, people just used what was on hand, corn cobs, parchment, even pages from the Farmer's Almanac. These days, we're clear-cutting our forests just to make something that we use once and flush down the toilet. That's time for a change. That's why you have to love Real Paper. Real makes a sustainable toilet paper that contains no trees and instead uses 100% bamboo, and Real Paper is certified by the Forest Stewardship Council, meaning that they are responsibly harvesting the bamboo grass that is used for their papers. Plus, while the other conventional tree-based papers are wrapped in plastic in the grocery aisle, Real Paper's packaging is plastic-free, compostable, and offers free shipping on all orders. Now, it's so comfortable and soft, you'll never go back to the old stuff. So join us in making a switch that makes a difference. And we also, you love how Real even partners with One Tree Planted. So with every box of Real that you buy, they are funding reforestation efforts across the country. Unlike other toilet papers that cut down trees, Real actually helps plant them. Real Paper is available in an easy, hassle-free subscriptions or for one-time purchases on your website. All orders are conveniently delivered to your door with free shipping and 100% recyclable, plastic-free packaging. Now, if you head to realpaper.com/warroom and sign up for a subscription using our code WARROOM at checkout, you'll automatically get 30% off your first order and free shipping. That's realpaper.com/warroom, or enter promo code WARROOM to get 30% off your first order plus free shipping. Let's just stop flushing our forest and try Real's tree-free paper. Real is paper for the planet. You can also find the link in our show notes. James, now for our listener questions, which are so good always. Let's start off with Robert in Santa Ana, California, who asks, will Biden's Gaza solution of constructing a U.S. military pier there that will take weeks to implement be interpreted as old man weaknesses by people he wants to appease, or a smart move?
Well, first of all, Santa Ana, that's right. And the airport they call SNA down there in Orange County. This is a really troubling problem. And in a minute here, it is. Remember, Biden knows this. He's got the Democratic convention coming up, and he's plenty old enough, as you and I are, to remember the 68 convention. And the uncomfortableness with what Israel is doing there. Sometimes people think, well, it's maybe some college kids or some people, you know, Palestinians that live in Dearborn or blah, blah, blah. It runs a lot deeper than that, a lot deeper. And he knows that this is a domestic political problem for him. Trump was horrible. If the people that were looking to have some think that the Palestinians are getting a bum deal, look at what Trump said. He didn't do anything they wanted. I mean, he didn't express an iota of any sympathy for him. But people are going to stay home, or hopefully they don't, but, you know, right now it looked like people would stay home. They would be unenthusiastic. They'd vote for a third party. And it's just so counter to your interest. If you look at it and if you're saying this is excessive and we should do what everyone knows we need to do is have some demilitarized zone up in the, you know, support from other Arab countries and a two-state solution. But that's not carrying the day. And I'm afraid a lot of people that have that vision for the Middle East are going to, in their anger or frustration, are
James,
going to do something stupid.
James, I agree with you. And I can put a plug in for us. Now, you and I started on Substack this week, Carville Uncensored. And I have a column that's going to come out early Friday morning, that the headline of which is Biden has to break with Bibi. I don't mean just rhetorical warning. He has to break and say, we cannot support you as long as this government is acting the way they are. I think that will be seen, should be seen as an act of strength, and it might just shake up Israeli politics enough to produce change. But it's a disaster right now.
It's a disaster. And it's a piece, I can't pronounce the guy's name right, in Foreign Affairs, that high-end magazine, by the editor Faretz. And man, the stunning negligence of Bibi Netanyahu. How can that fucking guy just sit there and stay in charge? That intelligence failure was worse than 9/11.
It was,
much
James,
worse.
There's what Bibi's doing is, number one, he's got to stay in power because otherwise he'll be criminally tried. And number two, he's going to, you know, wait it out. He's going to stiff Biden. He's going to wait for Donald Trump to be elected. That's his hope. And I really do think Biden needs to break with him. But
Look, I'm glad you wrote in a column, and because it's coming completely evident that he doesn't. How much money is the United States giving Israel?
$14 billion more in unconditional military assistance slated to come. So this is a good plug. Read us on Substack this week. We just started. Second question.
Yes,
James,
sir.
I'm going to violate one of our rules. I don't ask questions usually about topics we've already discussed. But I'm going to do it this time because it's from Steve in Devon, Pennsylvania. That's my hometown, so I've got to give Steve credit. Who wants to know the analysis of Biden's State of the Union? Well, I think we went through it. I think it was good. He's Joe Biden. He's not JFK. But I think he did as well as could be expected, and he laid out predicates. If they can build on, will be helpful.
Yeah, I think it was a real good speech. I mean, content, and you kind of name it. And again, the response was disastrous. I don't know how many people watched that. And the data shows that if people that saw it liked it. If you look at just talking to one of the bridge posters yesterday, they did Dow groups. And the Dow groups were very positive. But what we got to do here is change voting behavior. And that's a little bit tough enough to crack here. But I guess the idea is you keep having good events and they keep having bad events. And at some point, the voters will wake up to it. They seem
they
to wake up
so
to
far.
It on election day.
Hope it continues, Steve. Catherine in San Francisco, California, as we go across the country, ask, how can we get the media to pivot to Trump's age and mental decline? At least some coverage. Why not?
All right. So, by the way, I'm wave high to him in San Francisco right now myself. This is the construct. Biden is old. Okay. He makes jokes about it. Everybody knows. And when they did a focus group, so when you see Biden, the first thing that comes out of anybody's mouth is old. I'm not surprising anybody with this observation. So if you are the Democrats, do you point out all of Trump's word salad confusion and say, well, you thought we were bad, look at this? the argument against that is that if somebody, if you're trying to get somebody an axis of which they are going to decide this election is cognition, right now Biden would not win that, not closely. Not closely. And of course, other people, third parties will, but I think the Biden campaign should just stay away from Trump's cognition issue, because if it's going, well, you think I'm bad, look at you, or you think, and right now, Trump has a little bit of the upper hand in terms of people who think they have most energy or has the most cognition. So it's a good question.
Yeah, no, but you don't want to fight on that turf. I agree. You know, I agree that they're better. They're better grounds.
Right. To the extent that you can pivot.
James, we're staying out there on the West Coast. They must know you're out there, James, because another James in Mill Valley says, if the election comes down to less than 100,000 votes in seven swing states, why aren't Democrats concentrating all their efforts in those states? Well, they basically are to begin with. But let me tell you something else. The Republicans just announced their Election Integrity Project. And what their Election Integrity Project is, scare the living shit out of people and intimidate them from voting, put out bad information. Sometimes they've sent out notices giving the wrong day of election. And the people involved in this are not people who care about an honest, fair, free election. So what Democrats need to do, as they did very wisely after the last election, they had a law firm, which was basically Walter Dellinger and Seth Waxman and Don Verrilli, ready to go right after the election to take on the fraudulent Trump claims. They anticipated it. They got to do the same thing this time with this election fraud stuff and go after him now, not wait until November.
Well, if it gets that close, the Supreme Court will steal it. So one of the things going into this election, and the Democrats have to do everything really good, because we're not going to get the vote out of Philadelphia, Detroit, or Milwaukee, or even Maricopa in Phoenix, or Fulton. You're not going to get that kind of huge lead just given looking at the softness that I'm seeing in black vote and what I'm seeing in under 30 vote. So we don't have any choice but to contest other people. I think we'll do well with educated women, but we just got to cut these margins in rural America. We were talking about on the program with Paul and Tom. It's just, there's no other way to do it other than
You're going through that. Scott in Trumansburg, New York. Never been to Trumansburg, New York. Got to find out where it is, Scott. I don't think that's...
I had a girlfriend from Cloversville.
Who knows? But Scott, write us a note and tell us where it is. He said, if Trump loses again, do you think, and how will supporters go about attempting to overturn the results?
You know, I've thought about this and got asked about it. There's one thing that tells me that the reaction might, depending on the circumstances, they don't follow him. He didn't quite get the juice that he did. And all of those idiots are 4 years older. And a lot of them know people that spent time in jail and have probably concluded it's not the most pleasant thing you can do. I think you're right to worry about it, but I think there are indications that
Trump will try, but he may not have the he may not be able to con as much of the flock as he did last time. He never went to jail, James. It's only those people
Well, of course, it is what he's. You know, he's got that big civil suit coming. By the way, October 25th, they start the criminal trial in New York.
You're right.
I said March 25th.
James, staying out there in California. Daniel in San Juan Capistrano.
All right.
Worries about the Democrats holding to that Feinstein seat. There was a big split in the primary. Katie Porter has sulked and complained about it. Adam Schiff is running against Steve Garvey. Adam Schiff will win. I will guarantee you that. And the only worry I think a Democrat would have is if Garvey's able to somehow energize more Republicans to vote. I doubt that. I think it'll be a, double digit win.
I think you're right. And the polling was you know, first thing I saw was a little uncomfortably close. But what was Katie Porter's beef? I mean,
yeah, she lost by
Adam
well over
big,
a million votes.
Didn't he?
She's really been incredibly petulant. Also, yeah. James, it really makes me mad because it plays into the absolute lies Republicans say. Well, Democrats do the same thing about elections. They don't, and Katie Porter's doing it. And she...
Okay, so I didn't miss anything. You know what I'm saying? Well, lady, yeah. What do you mean? You just got the shit beat out of you. What does she think she's going to accomplish with this?
Finally, we're going to move away from California, James. The last question. It's from Gina in Dateline, Casper, Wyoming. I love Casper, Wyoming.
Oh, wow, Casper. Yeah, I think it's the biggest city in Wyoming. I think it's big and shiny, but I could
NBC
be wrong.
Reporter, a great Wyoming native. Anyway, Gina says, we simply cannot allow another hard right Supreme Court judge. Why isn't that a top tier issue for the Biden campaign, especially aimed at black voters, since the Roberts Court has castrated the Voting Rights Act?
Well, it's a good question. You know, there's a lot of speculation about Sotomayor. Should she resign while we have the Senate and let Biden pick somebody? And I got to tell you, people are traumatized by the Ruth Bader Ginsburg thing, to say the least. It's definitely, I mean, generally people will say, well, of course, it don't matter much in elections. People don't vote on it. That's not going to be true. And it is something that you got to ask constantly. Okay, and you got to ask at every level, do you support this in vitro fertilization ban? Do you support, banning abortions? Keep going. It's on the ballot. You can't tell people it doesn't matter who the Supreme Court is. They now know it matters profoundly. So, yeah,
They went after Roe v. Wade. They're going to come after abortion pills. And so... Listen to them.
You're goddamn right. Again, in birth control, look at all the statements they have.
Thank you for those questions. They're wonderful. If we didn't get to them, we'll send them again, and we'll try to get to them next week. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Beam, Naked Wines, and Real Paper, in the episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel, or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.